You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Well, I'll just say a couple of words about Dennis, his connection with MetaLab, and his teaching work at the Berkman. Dennis describes himself as a recovering software engineer. I'm glad to say he's not so recovered that he's not useful to have in the group when it comes to tech support and web design and that sort of thing. Dennis is also a recent PhD from Harvard's Department of Comparative Literature. And in his research, he makes this bracing call to consider all kinds of textual stuff as the stuff of literary experience and scholarly engagement and analysis. Everything from scientific reports to newspaper accounts, blog posts, recipes, comments on blog posts. Everything that we experience in text, we ought to view as literary behavior, and that we ought to all participate in understanding it as such. And I think that question of participation, cutting across boundaries, is very important to how Dennis sees his scholarship and how he wants his scholarship to engage in a kind of broad set of discourses, embracing not only literary scholars but readers of all kinds. Critics, technologists, media makers, everyone, in fact. Dennis teaches with our faculty co-director the Digital Humanities Seminar and Seminar on Experimental Criticism, where a lot of these ideas are brought to bear in the context of teaching. And MetaLab's so excited to have Dennis in the mix because he shares this vision that we have at MetaLab for incorporating technology in teaching, not as a kind of set of tools for, you know, showing slides on a wall or building websites and blogging opportunities for students, but getting students involved in making technology, in seeing technology as a mode of inquiry. Today, Dennis is going to be talking about the shape of knowledge in that context and how knowledge is breaking down these boundaries that have long divided realms as disparate as trade publishing, scholarly publishing, scholarly communication, making media, criticism, arts, and the humanities. So without further ado, Dennis Tennant.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us here on such a beautiful spring day, especially in spring break. And I'm glad to see a lot of familiar faces here and a lot of unfamiliar faces. And again, I thank you very much for coming. Before we start, I'd like to just kind of give two preliminary caveats to the talk. And the first is that this talk is less kind of a completed paper or a set of conclusions and more an invitation to participate in a thought experiment. And as such, I really encourage you to chime in. If you have any comments or questions, just feel free to interrupt. I think it's always good for the flow. For the flow of the presentation. The second kind of preliminary comment is that this is a very recent work that represents somewhat of a departure in my thinking, and is very much inspired by the spirit of this place, by the spirit of Berkman, which I would characterize as a mix between research and advocacy. I mean, this is the most inspiring thing for me here, in that almost every project that comes out of this place, people who study Wikipedia, people who study the blogosphere, the Youth and Media Lab, the Digital Public Library project, the open knowledge stuff that Peter Suber does, almost all of it, it's scholars who are not just writing stuff, but also trying to enact meaningful change in the communities that they study. This is particularly important in a discipline like the humanities and the literary studies from which I come, which often feels so alienating and so removed from kind of the immediate objects of our study. It reminds me of an anecdote that actually happened here at Harvard is I don't know if you knew that, but Vladimir Nabokov was used to work here in the Museum of Natural History. And Nabokov was classifying butterflies or whatnot. And he applied to work at the Slavic department here. And at the time, the head of the Slavic department was Roman Jakobsen. And Roman Jakobsen said they did not hire him. And he said, would you hire an elephant to teach zoology? That's the anecdote. Would you hire an elephant to teach zoology? And the answer for him was, of course not. And I think Berkman is the kind of place that would hire an elephant to teach zoology, and perhaps to kind of learn a lot from the elephant. So I appreciate the spirit. I'm inspired by it. The community and kind of my most immediate experience comes as a software engineer, a former software engineer, comes from the design of content management systems. Kind of in my in another professional hat, I'm a managing editor of Modernism and Modernity. So again, some kind of content management going on there. And of course, as any active scholar, I'm actively engaged in trying to publish my work and really looking at the system of academic publishing from both kind of from the back end and from the front end as a back end as an editor, from the front end as someone who submits articles to journals. My frustration often comes in this what I call kind of the iceberg phenomenon, in that we as scholars, maybe this is not true for everyone, but often it feels like we are asked to excavate kind of a tiny patch of knowledge somewhere in the tip of this giant iceberg of information, which is great, and you know, with the hopes that we're kind of expanding that kind of the boundaries a little bit. But when we are done excavating that tiny patch of ground, we kind of take the fruits of our labor and put it somewhere down deep below the water in the submerged kind of bottom of that iceberg. And that's frustrating. We're asked to take ownership of kind of a small part of that large ecosystem, and we often lack the perspective and lack the tools to look at the kind of the health of the system as a whole. So to combat, let me sit down here for a second. To combat this, in part, what I started doing is creating this large-scale bibliographic citation network maps. I'm going to bring one up in higher resolution here. So they look something. These maps look something like this. This right here is the Journal of Comparative Literature. The Journal of Comparative Literature for the first 10 years of its inception. So these are 10 years, approximately 500 articles, and this is generally what I would call the kind of this knowledge domain of comparative literature, as encapsulated by the journal. Journals are a great kind of object of study in that they have natural boundaries, natural institutional boundaries, natural editorial boundaries, natural, you know, they exist as a corpus and as a data set that kind of is very well separated from the world outside. Once I started mapping these things, I began just kind of, you know, it almost feels like you're exploring this large, either a planet or an ecosystem. I mean, it looks something like a petri dish. So let's just try to look at identify some features of this map. So first of all, it's worthy to know that as in a traditional network mapping, each node here represents a bibliographic reference, a citation. So something like this is probably an article that was contained in the original corpus. It's part of the original corpus, and it cites a bunch of other people. And each citation is represented by a node, and when the citation happens, we draw an edge. Within an whatever their all citations. So it's very likely. I mean, we don't know for sure, but it's very likely that this was actually within the original corpus within this 10 years. Whereas one of these guys is actually not, is outside, is published in some other journal, and therefore you expect a shape like this or like this to come up. To indicate that this was part of the original data set. So this is pretty interesting. Another interesting feature of this data set is you will see that the articles here very rarely connect to each other directly. So in this particular domain, people rarely cite each other. It's a fairly sparsely connected network, and they do often cite these canonical texts. And in fact, part of what can be done with this kind of data sets is creating anthologies or canons programmatically. Right? You can kind of imagine that these are the guys that are constitute some sense of a canon within this discipline. I just labeled. I have this running as live data, but it's very slow. So I just labeled selectively. Yeah. In this case, yes. So this has been cited twice, and I'm sure I could clean it up a little bit more. And so sometimes, if there was like an error, or if there's kind of additional junk in the title, I may have miscounted one or two instances. But it's pretty accurate. Now here's another feature of this particular domain is you will see that there are a lot of features like this. So here are people who are kind of out there. You know, in the desert, and they're not really connected to the rest of the domain. Question is why, right? What does this tell us about this particular journal? It could be that they're writing on a very obscure topic, right? There's a specialist in the Swahili language that nobody else speaks, and there are, I guess, not much scholarship written in this particular journal. It could be also that they're citing, that they're very connected, just not within this particular domain, right? This is the Journal of Comparative Literature. It could be that they're being cited elsewhere, or they're citing people from a totally different domain. And here, to start asking these questions, I mean, you really need to go through and click through the individual article and look at kind of the different scale to see whether any of these intuitions are borne out. Let me show you the same journal in the last 10 years. So this is the same journal, Comparative Literature, but now for the last 10 years. The first slide was the first 10 years of its existence. This one, the last 10 years of its existence. No. So it was 1978. So the first was 1978 to 1988, and this is from 2000 onwards. But the same number, 500. 500 articles. You will see. So what has happened in this, you know, 30 or 40 years? You can't really see that very well. Let me zoom in. So one thing to note is that the network got a bit more connected. You still don't have. It's still quite rare for the articles in the original corpus to connect directly. They usually connect through another node. But you will see that in the last 10 years, these nodes are no longer primary texts. So originally, you saw that they were all citing Ovid and Shakespeare canonical texts like this. Here, they're beginning to cite, or here, they're citing other seminal kind of theoretical texts in this corpus. So you see Derrida here, Homi Bhabha, Jameson, David Damrosch, and I think, very funny, the most cited source in this particular corpus is Spivak, The Death of the Discipline. It's pretty much right in the middle of this particular domain. As before, we have a lot of features like this. We have areas that are completely disconnected from the center. And generally, as you will later see, journals in the humanities tend to display this type of clustering pattern, very strongly clustered towards the middle and kind of isolates on, towards the edges. Just as a point of comparison, let me give you another comparative literature journal, this one called Comparative Literature Studies. So this is a different journal, and also for the past, this is data for the past 10 years, just like the previous slide. Now you will see even, I mean, this looks even more sparse than comparative literature in the 1970s. And you see much more, many more kind of isolates. Oops. You see areas like this just all around here. And finally, let me show you kind of some journals from kind of other fields. Here's Econometrica. You see, so Econometrica is one of the top journals in economics. This is also a decade, roughly 500 articles. So the same number of articles, much more densely connected. It happens much more often that the articles are connected directly. You will also very rarely see towards the edges. There are almost no isolates here, right? And another, I think, feature that's interesting here is you see strong clustering. You see a cluster here, a cluster here, a cluster here, and another here. Now, these clusters, this is not exactly my area of expertise, economics, but I can kind of guess from the frequently cited sources here is this is probably stuff on game theory, Jerome. This is probably a cluster on decision theory, I'm guessing, Gilboa and... I'm not sure. This cluster here is kind of quantitative methodology, as far as I can tell, right here. I have a few other points of comparison, just for the interest sake. Here is Social Inquiry, 1998 to 2011. You see kind of, it looks somewhat similar to Econometrica. Again, strong connection, strong clustering. The clusters, again, could be identified. So you have, let me show you. So you have here's a cluster on social movements, which is a popular topic. Here you have a cluster on, let's see, so this is crime and delinquency and so on. So, generally, this is the kind of stuff I've been doing, but actually this is all, we're still on the first slide, this is all part of the introduction, actually. So what was happening is I gave this talk in the beginning of this year, or kind of a version of this talk, in a comparative literature conference. And it was kind of scary because the editor of both comparative literature and comparative literature studies, the two journals that kind of were the main focus of my analysis, both of the editors were sitting right there in the front row, and kind of it's a little bit dicey. Somewhere in the middle of my presentation, a woman raises her hand and says, excuse me, you keep talking about before I say that, when I do these presentations, I usually refer, as I said, they look, these diagrams, they look kind of organic, right? They look like a petri dish, and the individual elements kind of look like either starfish or, like, I think during that presentation, I kept referring to these things as broccoli. And it's just because I find the language of graph theory somewhat arid. The talk of edges and vertices and so on, it's a little bit off-putting, especially when you're in a room full of comparative literature editors. So the woman raises her hand and says, "Excuse me. You keep talking of broccoli and bushes and trees, but do you care about the planet?" She says. And I was totally kind of taken aback by this comment, and I said, I had to think about it, and I said, well, I personally do care about the planet, but here I'm really using the words like bush and broccoli and tree is kind of, they're metaphorical, and this talk is really not about, you know, like real ecology and so on. But when I went home from that talk, I was somewhat dissatisfied with my answer, because it is true, is that very naturally, I find myself falling into this metaphors of some sort of organic or evolutionary metaphors as applied to these essentially knowledge systems. So I started really trying to take her comment more seriously. Well, what does it mean actually to think in a more organic, evolutionary kind of way about knowledge systems? And at the same time, I was also searching for just a theoretical framework that could help me kind of frame this type of research. So the, you know, the metaphor of organic knowledge, right? It goes obviously goes back all the way to the Bible. If you remember Garden of Eden, the book of Genesis, God says, "But of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof, you shall surely die." I started kind of just collecting this type of metaphors. This is perhaps another kind of famous source for this type of a metaphor, and that's comes from Plato's Phaedrus. If you remember, in Plato's Phaedrus, Socrates is walking outside with his student Phaedrus, and they're talking about discourse. They're talking about making speeches. And they're talking about textual instruments. In the middle, they switch to talking about love, and this is a topic of great interest to Socrates. And they conclude coming back to frame this dialogue to talk about discourse once again. And so Socrates says, and Plato writes, "Serious discourse about the just, the good, and the beautiful is far nobler when one deploys the dialectic method and plants and saws in the fitting soul intelligent words which are able to help themselves and him who planted them, which are not fruitless but yield seed from which there spring up in other minds other words capable of continuing the process forever and which make the possessor happy to the farthest limit of human happiness." So again, the metaphor here is of words, of discourse, of text as something that's being planted in the human mind, and of kind of proper words, proper discourse, as something that's fruitful, as something that goes forth and multiplies in some sense. Again, topical for this dialogue, which has to do with love and knowledge. In the early 20th century, and not long after Darwin's work, people, psychologists and epistemologists, began to try to formalize this type of metaphors into an actual area of study. So James Mark Baldwin, an American philosopher and experimental psychologist, for example, wrote this essay called, it's from 1909, "The Influence of Darwin on Theory of Knowledge and Philosophy." He writes, "The mind has built up a structure, as the body has, and by a similar method, that of tentative and experimental adjustment, followed up by the correlated organic structure fixed by selection." So the idea here is that we have a body that is somehow adapted to our environment. So we have legs because we needed to run or walk or whatever, and the mind, whatever structures exist in the human mind, were formed by the similar process of selection. Further down, he writes, "The selective processes that have molded the individual have turned on collective utilities. In the social sciences and in the theory of knowledge, community, or some equivalent term, is henceforth to be the watchword." And here he's kind of saying that, yes, the ideas exist in the mind, but these selective processes also work in some sense on whole communities, because knowledge is shared by members of the community, although it's not very clear whether kind of the individual units of knowledge exist kind of in individual minds or whether how they are preserved and so on. It's not very clear in Baldwin's work, at least. However, interesting that, you know, he points towards this kind of social construction of knowledge type of direction in epistemology. He writes, again, the theory of the communities or common validities of knowledge and that of the corresponding communities or common interests of society is our new possession. Right? It's almost like a discovery, sense of a discovery here. Middle 20th century, 1960s, Donald Campbell came up with this term evolutionary epistemology. And he's famous for working on this problem, philosophical problems of creative thought or novel solutions. This is an interesting problem philosophically because in thinking about knowledge that's not yet discovered, we have to imagine a way of getting to something that you don't already know. It's knowing what you don't already know, which seems somehow paradoxical. So he comes up with this kind of formula. He says that creative thought is blind variation plus selective retention. And for creative thought to happen, or for novel solutions to happen, three conditions are necessary, he writes. A mechanism for introducing variation, a consistent selection process, and a mechanism for preserving and reproducing for selected variation. So this is pretty much the classic string of Darwinian evolution, which is usually described as variation, selection, and reproduction. Yeah, variation, selection, and reproduction. Now, note he kind of snuck this one. He says three things are necessary, but actually the third thing is preservation and selection, which kind of makes sense. I mean, here we imagine kind of the scientific process of kind of somebody sitting there looking for solving an equation or something, or and really going through all possible alternatives for this particular given problem. And there must be a method to get rid of stuff that doesn't work and a way to actually preserve stuff that does work. So preservation is a part of it because, I mean, really when imagining this process, I have to imagine somebody with like a pen and a piece of paper. And then there is some sense of a stable environment in which this idea must, in some sense, take hold. Now, of course, in classic Darwinian theory, preservation is always there as well. We have to imagine that wherever genes live is kind of, in some sense, a stable type of a replicator. So if you imagine a universe where you have a variation, selection, and reproduction, but let's say every time that cycle happens, the universe reboots and the laws of physics are different, for example, that would totally mess up your system. So the medium has to be in some sense stable. There must be the preservation of this process. And finally, he writes, all processes leading to expansions of knowledge involve a blind variation and selection and selective retention process. Good enough. So that's Donald Campbell. And I think probably the most popular application of this idea of evolutionary epistemology is Richard Dawkins. Probably you've all heard of the selfish gene. He's the guy who people usually say that he invented the word meme. It's probably not true. I'm guessing that I know at least in 1945 Van Bush wrote this piece on As We May Think in the Atlantic, where he coins the term memex, which is kind of this apparatus that will help you deal with the deluge of information. So who knows? But in any case, Dawkins first kind of slams other people who are trying to do evolutionary epistemology type of stuff, and says that the analogy between cultural and genetic evolution has frequently been pointed out, sometimes in the context of quite unnecessary mystical overtones, which is reviewing the literature, it's true. Very often, people who are not scientists treat the underlying theory more as a matter of faith and less as a kind of just a set of propositions. True enough, my favorite quote from Dawkins, the new soup is the soup of human culture. I love that, the new soup. And of course, referring to kind of the primordial soup from which stuff comes out. He then coins this term memes, says examples of memes are tunes, ideas, catchphrases, clothes, fashions, ways of making pots or of building arches, and so on. He then says the meme is a scientific idea. Its spread will depend on how acceptable it is to the population of individual scientists. A rough measure of its survival value could be obtained by counting the number of times it is referred to in successive years in scientific journals. Kind of interesting, kind of what a little bit what I'm doing with my mapping. But note that after all this, he says the computers, he talks a little bit about computers, but he says the computers in which memes live are human brains, right? Human brains. So I have to, after doing this review of literature, I have to ask myself, is this actually a metaphor? Is this a metaphor for doing things, or is this a model, right? Now, the difference between metaphor and model, if you know, metaphor is, when you make a metaphor, not all things kind of map between the two concepts. So if I say, you know, your eyes are the window to your soul, so the eyes, so there are eyes and windows, and both can be looked through, but I don't know, eyes, some things don't map, like eyes are not made of glass, they're not dusty, they don't have wooden frames, and so on. Right, so in a metaphor, kind of usually one or two things map and are extended semantically, but other things don't, are not extended. A model is much more robust. A model, a good model, many more things are extended from one concept to another, right? If the window was a model of the eye, we would think that kind of all the constituent parts of the window would kind of correspond to something in the eye. So there seems to be some conclusion, confusion here. So, for example, this is biology, right? There are units of analysis, genes. There is an organism, right? There is then a group or a community that was suggested in our reading. Then there are the usual kind of biological taxonomy, you know, species, family, order, class, phylum, and so on. There is life. The very distinction between organic and inorganic, that was the question that I was asked, right? Are you actually talking about, you know, broccoli? Do you actually care about kind of organic things? And of course, there's environment, which has both organic and inorganic things in it. So if we imagine this kind of structure connected to the gene, kind of the consecutive circles, right, in which the gene lives, where does the meme live? And that's a little bit confusing to me. Does the meme live in the brain? Or is the meme part of the larger organism? Like, is the meme part, like a novel is an organism made up of little memes? There's some literature kind of makes that suggestion. It's curious, but I'm not sure about it. What is the environment? Again, we saw some people suggest that it's the human brain. Other people suggest that the kind of the environment for the meme to live is, you know, books or journals or whatever, right? At which level, when we imagine this evolutionary chain, at which level does selection work, for example? So in genes, we know that selection works on organisms, right? Selection does not work directly on the gene. Let's say if you imagine like a mountain goat, right? The mountain goat lives somewhere where there are mountains and wolves. So it learns how to climb mountains to run away from the wolves. It has like nice hooves. That's its adaptation. Dawkins, for example, suggests that selection works directly on the meme, right? And the other kind of evolutionary psychologists suggest that as I'm sitting there solving a problem or something like that, I'm actually going, like I am the selection process and I'm going through some sort of evolutionary process in my mind. Again, I'm somewhat confused by this metaphor. So, as I was thinking about this, I thought, well, this is difficult for me to apply to journals to kind of my research because journals are really messy, and it's not very clear what is a meme and what is not a meme. It's a fairly complex environment. And the obvious, very simple environment was memes, kind of like internet memes, which are actually very simple. They live in a much more transparent environment. So just as an experiment, I did kind of started thinking about memes as part of this. Would the evolutionary kind of metaphor, how would it do describing the environment of internet memes? So as you know, a meme. I'm thinking about variation. So a meme is composed of three things: background, character, text. So this is a popular meme: advice animal. It's an animal that gives you advice, and you can imagine just kind of algorithmically cycling through these components and producing a great number of memes, which kind of what happens. However, these memes are somewhat related to each other. This is kind of, again, this is just for fun. I did kind of like a genealogical tree of memes. So you have the advice animal here. It produces something like, this is a Sanity Wolf who gives you like sane advice. From Sanity Wolf, there's Insanity Wolf. And actually, what I did is I'm scraping a quick meme, which is kind of a very large database of these things. And you could tell that, for example, this one comes after the other one. So you can tell that the variation came up later. So there is the socially awkward penguin that does something awkward. There's the awesome penguin that does something awesome. And then people like literally just go through every possible variation that could be. They kind of, they're like socially awesome, awkward penguin, socially awkward, awesome penguin, the double penguins this way. And then there are really crazy ones like that, where they're just like triple combinations in kind of which way, where he's awkward, then awesome, then awkward again. And then there are these kind of difficult to read here, but late generation memes like this. Here we kind of understand this idea of variation and reproduction is kind of understandable. They're actual kind of replicators like Quick Meme and Meme Base that are made to replicate and to produce variation in this very small kind of units of meaning. Another nice thing about memes is that we have a lot of data on them, and the system is fairly transparent. So, for example, this is the number of clicks for socially awesome penguin, and it's for about a year, and the scale is logarithmic. This is incorrect. This is number of views. This is a number of views for the socially awesome penguin, and it's staggering. It goes up into the close to a million. No, just one. Quick meme. It's just, I don't have the date. I only have the month. So they're just binned by month. Basically, I mean, it's simple. The number, this particular kind of the life cycle of the socially awesome penguin is more people are looking at him. Quick meme also has this rating system, which is interesting. It has this rating. You can rate something bad, average, or awesome. And they post the rating as well. So you see something like the meme is becoming more awesome, I guess. And this is similar to the click-through. If you do any work with advertising, this is similar to the click-through rate. However, it's not quite click-through rate because you imagine that somebody came to this page and clicked awesome, and then the next person clicked terrible. And it, you know, the rating actually went back down to zero. And then again, just as a thought experiment, I thought, why not come up with something like virulence, a measure, an index of virulence, where it's an index between the rating and the number of views. So this was kind of unexpected. So this is against our socially awesome penguin, and you saw that the rating was going up, the views were going up, but the actual kind of ratio, what they call virulence, is somehow less virulent. Less people are actually liking this particular meme. It's declining. In some sense, its popularity is declining. Now again, I'm just playing around here and thinking about there are very many intuitions that could explain this, right? So the kind of the market is being saturated with this particular meme, that maybe kind of newer memes have a different curve in virulence. Again, just interesting to ask these questions from this particular database. Now, these are some more numbers here. These are different strains. So, you know, socially awesome penguin, socially, socially awkward, socially awesome, and different combinations. And then the crazy third and fourth generation, the ones that are really caught up. Now, you will see that, again, a surprising finding was that my virulence index actually was very high for the socially awesome penguin. So for some people, for some reason, people people rate socially awesome penguin much higher than the awkward one. Another interesting thing, it's kind of suggested by Dawkins, is to measure the survival rate. What the meme database gives us that journals do not is access to failure. So I would very much like to get my hands on rejected articles. And actually, there is some thinking going on around about how to capture some of the kind of rejection in the academic journal database. Here we have all the failed specimens. So with the socially awkward penguin, of the close to 70,000 examples that are available on this site, only 1,000 kind of have rating over 100. So that's kind of anybody with a rating under 100 could be considered dead, or you could just try to make an arbitrary boundary and say that these are really not circulating. These particular memes are really no longer circulating, and some of them, when you look at them, they're just not funny or bad or misspelled and so on. Why is the socially awesome penguin more popular? Is it the red color? Is it because it's a positive message? Perhaps. This is something that could be tested experimentally. So I want to say that these particular slides, I'm going down that evolutionary chain, right? So we addressed variation. Here are some selection pressures. So we have access to kind of alive and dead specimens. And finally, this matter of preservation is interesting to me as well, is because so these memes usually operate in Reddit and 4chan and similar communities. And the very nice thing there is that Reddit makes their code available. It's an open source code. 4chan is also available, although they have a proprietary kind of ranking algorithm, but it's based on a project that is widely available. And you can actually kind of crack the hood and see how are things being ranked. What kind of pressures does the technological design of the system? What kind of pressures what kind of selection pressures does it provide for the units of knowledge or information that circulate within? And so here are some just initial observations. Reddit, as you know, is rank based. So Reddit, you have to click. If you like something, you click up. If you don't like it, you click down. This type of ranking is community-driven. The algorithm itself emphasizes newness. It decays. So something that's new is kind of immediately ranked higher than something that's old. And being old is kind of very heavily penalized in the ranking algorithm. It's a logarithmic ranking algorithm in that it... something that's ranked 100 is kind of something that receives 100 upvotes is similar to something that receives 500. Or another way to think about this is the first 100 votes are much more important than the second 100 votes. So logarithmic scale. The ranking system really penalizes downvotes. This is quite interesting if you think about what effects it has on the system. So something that's controversial, something that would receive a lot of attention, both up and down votes, would be rated lower than something that's just receiving up votes. So this could explain, maybe this explains why the positive penguin is more popular or gets more virulence than the negative penguin. Point is, if you're posting content that is at all controversial, it is less likely to get to the front page. Interesting, right? The environment itself kind of has a model or pushes for a certain model of the content within. Reddit is pseudo-anonymous. Again, another interesting point of selection. People have accounts, and people kind of care about their accounts. They collect karma or whatever. They also frequently have multiple accounts. For, let's say, if you're going to flame someone or say some negative stuff, you're going to do it on a different account, and you want like your original account to remain kind of tied to your to that particular way of voting. So that's quite interesting. Reddit as a system does not allow duplicate links. It saves all the things. It saves everything. Not being unique is penalized, although, of course, it doesn't prevent a lot of kind of repetition there. 4chan, which is another place where these memes operate, the algorithm is kind of just a top of the pile algorithm. It's community driven, and it emphasizes in engagement. It's this last touch kind of thing. So basically, whatever something is touched, being commented upon, it jumps to the top of the pile. A new post jumps to the top of the pile, the pile has a limited size, so it constantly squeezes out everything that's not being touched. It squeezes it out from the last page. This, unlike Reddit, promotes controversy because you don't care whether you're getting positive as long as somebody's commenting on your stuff, right? You don't care whether it's positive or negative. So it would. We would expect this type of system to kind of bubble up different types of information. It is anonymous rather than pseudo-anonymous. Again, we can think about what effect that has on the type of material that circulates and on the type of the engagement that this community provides. It also has no institutional memory, right? It saves 4chan itself does not have an archive. When I was thinking about it, I was thinking, what are other systems that we know of that don't really have an institutional archive? So think about folk poetry, for example, right? The oral tradition of poetry, where you're never really saving anything, writing anything down. Again, you would have an emphasis on smaller units that could be remembered. You have an emphasis on rhyming, right? You have a limited corpus that displays high variation, right? So basically, I tell you a poem, you tell it to your friend, you introduce your own little variations, but the number of poems overall is small because we can't really remember. We can't really remember very many poems, and the stuff that's nobody touching, the stuff that's nobody kind of... you told me 5 poems, I only chose to kind of remember 4, that fifth one falls out of the corpus in some sense. So these systems, I want to say, is actually have some kind of analogies in the more traditional non-digital world. So to go back to our metaphor or model, is this a metaphor or a model? I don't know. I still kind of remain on the fence. I'm okay with it being a metaphor because I'm a literary scholar, and I think you can get pretty far with a compelling metaphor in terms of your research. So that's okay by me. I still think that following kind of this, following the relatively orthodox evolution theory has allowed us to provide a robust and a thick, relatively thick description, just of the meme, the individual meme, but of the whole ecosystem. And I think this will be useful to apply for my journal work as well. So that's fine. The second kind of observation that I would like to make by the means of a conclusion is about comparative work. There is much opportunity here for comparison. You saw with journals, you gain understanding of these visualizations when you begin cutting by time slices, for example, or when you begin cutting across disciplines, right? Or when you cut your data across cultures. Do Russian journals look similar to the American journals in the humanities? And in a sense, comparative work is very similar to kind of the spirit, not the spirit, but the actual experimental method, right? The comparison is what gives you that sense of a control, right? Of some data that's control data. But also think of comparative work across media. I mean, I think I'm very interested. There's a lot of work being done on mapping out the blogosphere, mapping out Twitter networks. Now, these are different from the networks I'm drawing in that the Twitter networks are often actually social networks. They're a connection between people and not a connection between texts. But still, I think there might be some interesting conclusions or research to be done at the kind of crossroads of traditional media and new media in that they both, I think, enrich each other in some way. So, for example, we had this conversation about some particularities about the Russian Wikipedia. So I think Meike was telling me that the Russian ratio of editors to kind of just passive readers is higher in Russia than anywhere else. The question is why, and I think part of the answer could lie in understanding not just this ecosystem of Wikipedia, but seeing this system of Wikipedia next to other print-based, more traditional ecosystems within which information lives. The same could be said about very interesting findings from the mapping the Iranian blogosphere projects. Again, just when you see features that cannot be explained from within the system, it's very useful to do comparative work in that sense. And finally, no matter how silly penguins and wolves seem, they, I think, provide a natural laboratory environment for designing knowledge systems. In thinking about the future of academic publishing, we may want to adopt or reject certain features borrowed from 4chan or Reddit, provided we understand their effects, the effects of the environment and the selection pressures applied by the system as a whole. So, for example, the need for greater transparency, the fact that I can kind of understand the sorting algorithms of Reddit is very nice, and the fact that those algorithms could be tweaked is quite nice. So we were just recently reading an article on a Reddit-like system for submitting things to your mayor or something like that. You could readily imagine the adaptation of these type of ranking systems into other environments. But again, you would have to understand that, for example, if controversy is important to you and you want to preserve controversy, understanding the ranking system is, you would have to kind of tweak the algorithm to the way you like it. More numbers in a journal submission kind of field. We have very little access, especially in the humanities, to citation statistics, to rejection numbers. And again, as I was saying, we don't very well capture kind of failed submissions. There's been a lot of conversation about this publish first, review later model, which is again suggested by Reddit. Is you put it out there first and wait to see what falls out, and kind of start reviewing later. And if you want to go more radical, considering the effects of anonymity and pseudo-anonymity on scholarly publishing, there is no reason why we could not experiment with kind of a greater publication in kind of anonymous forms. And it does have a long history, actually, before the 20th century. Reviews are already blinded, for example. So there's already points of the journal system which kind of encourage complete anonymity. And other kind of more radical stuff that you can learn from this is perhaps even an algorithmic production of knowledge. I mean, after all, Dawkins and early work on evolutionary epistemology suggests that innovation happens in this variation and selection. So as long as you set up a system that is blindly variable and has some selective pressures, you could imagine. So you could very easily imagine like a machine for producing an infinite number of those penguins and spamming Reddit with those penguins, and the best ones will somehow float to the top. That would be all for me in terms of the conclusions. Welcome your questions.
Dennis, one question. Thinking about the sort of memetics of the penguins, it doesn't seem like what that particular ecosystem is selecting for is richness of variation, right? It seems like, in terms of pure population biology, so to speak, the biggest population is a relatively simple species of meme, right? The fourth and fifth order memes, there are very few of them, and the ones that seem to thrive are the simplest and the happiest. So, I mean, how would you hack that ecosystem to tend towards richness or an upswing in the sophistication or the variation of what gets produced? Presuming even that would be a good thing. It seems like that's the sort of thing we'd want more out of an ecosystem of scholarly communication. Yeah.
Well, I think I already suggested that part of the reason why there is great variation but a relative kind of simplicity of the corpus is because there is very weak mechanism of institutional memory. So even though Reddit kind of keeps everything and you can access the archive, it's not really designed for you to go back to see what was written a year ago, unless you're just searching for a link to make sure it's not a...
readability isn't sort of feeding back into the system right away.
The readability is not feeding back into the system, whereas the journal publishing ecosystem is very much set up for long-term access. So and we haven't really touched on these issues, but issues of access and preservation, that's where preservation comes into being. I think they themselves shape the complexity of discourse in some way. Yeah, please.
Hi. So I think this is great, fascinating, and I spend most of my time worrying about memes and flow in the media sphere, so it's really interesting. But I guess I'm really struggling with the idea that this thing that we call meme that lives, cute cat pictures or cute penguin pictures that we call memes have anything substantive to do with this sort of notion of a knowledge meme. Like, it's a sticker, right? I mean, it's not... The interesting things about memes is that they're substantive ideas that we struggle with and that flow into each other and that we combine into these larger, interesting bodies of knowledge. And this penguin picture, it's fun, it's interesting, it's sort of a cultural icon, but it's not... I feel like the applicability to, a scientific idea or a framing of a political agenda and the kinds of things that we really care about sort of mapping to figure out how our sort of larger social discourse is working, there's not much of a connection there. And so I worry a little bit about drawing larger... you could be voting on what your favorite pizza is, right? And is a voting system for your favorite pizza... there's certainly something we can learn from any voting or evolutionary system for sort of peer-reviewed journals or for, the media ecology, but there's something pretty fundamental missing there in sort of understanding how really substantive knowledge means.
Yeah. No, I mean, I kind of agree. That's why I wouldn't spend much time like doing closed readings of meme for, to gain some kind of cultural insight. And that's why I concentrate more on the systematic kind of features of this environment, and I think the systematic features. I hope I made it there are some compelling kind of lessons to be learned for, as you said, any type. If you have any kind of sort of information circulating in some environment, being ranked, being upvoted, downvoted, cited, not cited, these are lessons in systems design. And we are kind of in a unique time now where so normally the systems of knowledge propagation, they're ad hoc. They kind of are built around us by not us. You know, we inherited them from generations of practice. And we are in a moment now where we could have a hand in actually designing new systems within which our work circulates. And I think we must take ownership of that, and we must kind of participate in the design of knowledge systems in some ways. And here, Reddit, 4chan, whatever, Quick Meme, they are kind of ready-made experiments for us. We can choose to draw lessons from them or choose to draw kind of cautionary tales from them. But I think it is useful. Please. Thank you.
I was thinking of a few things. I don't know if anyone in this room has signed the Cost of Knowledge petition. I did. That was started by the Mathematician Society. And I mean, part of what we talk about is shared knowledge, is a shared understanding of what is considered goodness. In this particular case, the co-editors of one of our elite journals happens to have the office next to me and is one of my best friends. And so I took myself out of, I can't review, write, or, you know, do these things for them. And so in shared knowledge, but we've given this, we gave this away. We sold the journals. Our societies that we rely on sold the journals to these. You know, it was passive in a sense that, you know, when you offer a society $800,000, it seems like just a ton of money to the society, but it's not to the people who bought the journal.
Right.
And we weren't in cycle. So I think when we're trying to say about changing the system, we can't, you know, it's we have to almost go back to our roots that of going way back to the time when what the journals and the shared knowledge bases began as, and then realize that we are not always the best custodians of ourselves, of taking care of our own knowledge base. We can blame Elsevier, but we also let Elsevier.
Yeah.
You know, we let them take it over, and now we're paying for it. And, you know, we're paying for that. We're, you know, Wiley Blackwell. It models in media as well. But, it, you know, like this post review of scientific information, I wonder if there's going to be an equivalent of the Yelp model. You know, after a while, everyone has said the same thing, so you get the fall off of the penguins, because everyone has been said about the penguin, and they go off to find a aardvark, you know, to talk about. But I remember one time when I was a young upstart, and I was reviewing a book for someone, and she said, "Are you sure you want to write this review? Because if you ever come up with a book, they're going to be waiting to come back, because I wrote a very negative review, and they're going to come back and snap at you." So I think we have some, you know, there's some really bigger issues that we have up there in the cloud that I don't not sure we've completely wrapped ourselves around. You know, how we, as the people who create this knowledge, manage it ourselves.
Yeah. No, and it's clear. I don't know if everybody knows the story. Is that kind of, I think it happened in the early 90s, right? Is that many journals who could not afford to publish their own, do the actual post-production, the printing of their journals, they kind of sold their rights to the journals to these large aggregate firms who are doing quite well, by the way. Despite of what you hear about the decline of publishing, the larger academic publishers, I think they withered the financial crisis pretty well, partly because they sell their journals in bulk to libraries who sign up in perpetuity to purchase all of the journals within. And in the early 90s, this seemed like a good kind of bargain with the devil, but I think today it seems like a terrible deal, as you would suggest, and partly because we've isolated ourselves from the selectionary pressures. Point is that the journal doesn't. So the journal I edit for, we get paid nothing, and most of the labor is free. 99% of the labor in the journal is free. It goes then into some kind of ecosystem design. You know, there's Scholar One and all kinds of paywalls. I mean, it's a fairly complicated picture there. But the thing is, they don't really care. The company that aggregates, it doesn't care what's inside. It will sell it if it's total garbage or if it's really good. It will sell it just the same to the library. The library is forced to buy. It's like, you know, when you buy cable and you have to buy along with, you just want HBO, but along with HBO you have to buy, you know, everything else that that comes with it. So, community such as Wikipedia, such as Reddit, give me hope that we already are working for free. And once post-production becomes less of a concern, money-wise, we can begin experimenting with these systems. Please.
On the two graphs that you showed, like, or some of the ones from the different disciplines. Yeah. Do you have a sense if the ones with all the isolated ideas represent more of a multiplicity of viewpoints, or that people don't know what other folks are talking about? And so, like, when you said the economics journal, there was a lot of clustering. Do you know if that represents a lot of agreement on what's a good source, or a lot of controversy over the same kind of canonical sources? Yeah.
This is, as you can imagine, this is kind of a controversial question, because it kind of strikes to the root of the discipline and to all kinds of practices, citation, editorial practices that are within. I have an intuition. I have not. I would like to. I think as I go on, I would like to kind of answer it more empirically. But my intuition is that isolation is that this is kind of a sign of a relatively sick ecosystem, that isolation is bad, citation is good. Let's just be very simplistic about it. Being connected directly to your peers, I think, is positive. And think about what that signifies. I mean, in the real world, being connected to your peers means you're actively reading your peers' work. If you actually, and as a graduate student in comparative literature, no, that's actually a rarity. Is that we very often cite texts that are canonical, that come, you know, that are 70, 40, 30 years old, but very rarely cite peers. There's kind of very little sharing of early drafts going on in the humanities department, and I think this is kind of the sign on the other end. Again, it's just my intuition at this point. And the same thing holds for clustering. I think systems that are centralized like this are not. I think it's better when you see strong clustering, because that means that people are thematically, or whether there is a conflict, there are different schools. That's actually good. It's a sign of rich intellectual activity. So, you know, again, you don't want to. It's not. I just want to be clear. It's not about gaming the system. It's not about producing a prettier image. This is more kind of a diagnostic tool, in some senses.
On the other side of that, though, what if the isolated ideas map to other disciplines? What if it's someone who's influenced by art history, let's say?
And yes.
My question is more, what is going to be the unit of your study? Here it's a journal in a particular field. How do you get a layering effect so that you can make connections with other disciplines and interdisciplinary work?
No, that's a great question. And so there could be, like I said, there could be various theories of why these are isolates. And I could, for example, do two different domains and see whether they connect. I do have a little bit of a sense here whether they. It's again somewhat indirect. Let me show you. Let's see if I can find it. Here's American anthropologists. Let's see if you spot the yellow dot. Oh, there you go. So what I've done is the size of the dot here represents citation within this domain, right? And the color of the dot is just, it's a number that I get from the Web of Knowledge, is how many times Web of Knowledge says that it was globally cited everywhere, right? So this particular article is kind of like cited maybe a few times within this corpus, but it was cited a lot by other by outside places. So we know, I don't know whether it cites, it's very well connected, but I know other people outside of this domain cite it. And you will see, again, I would hope that it's good to have kind of a high global citation count, and I would hope to see lots of yellow dots on all of these diagrams, and that's just not the case. You see, they're kind of so it's a glimpse. It's something again that another slice of the data could show this much better. Natasha was next.
Do you think that the field of comparative literature per se is more kind of heterogeneous, because we have a single department of economics and we have a bunch of departments of national literatures plus the comparative literature department plus whatever the department of linguistics and be associated with this journal you referred to first. Reason why those connections are so difficult to build within this large field.
Absolutely, and if you remember, I think what's very nice here is that when I say domain, I don't say just a corpus. I say domain because besides the corpus of texts, we have the associated institutions, cultural practices, and so on. It's a very complicated knot of kind of things, and certainly that's part of the problem. But again, that may be something that needs to change. Maybe it's not good to have a field that has 10 different departments that are not sitting next to each other. It's again part of that larger conversation. But certainly, I think that's very plausible. So it's these guys may be just not. Actually, this is anthropology. I think we have to stop, so maybe one more, or I think we can.
Well, I might just say one more quick thing, because I do know we have to stop.
Yeah.
You're also catching one kind of behavior here, right? Bibliographic citation, and different disciplines have different kind of discourses that they're engaged in, much of which is not caught by this particular slice through the data, right? So, you know, when you're looking at economics, you're looking at a kind of discourse that is much more kind of immediately agonistic in papers, where you're picking up the citations of others and dispensing with them in one way or another, where there's a different kind of model in literary studies that's much more about engagement with texts, and the agonistic engagement is happening in seminars and in courses in places that are not yielding data for this. So the question is, do you want a discipline that's more like that kind of open-ended, agonistic, discursive framework of the of economics or the sciences, or more like the kind of literary model? You know, is there a change in the kind of disciplinary dynamics that might be called for, or might be interesting to experiment with, rather than a way of capturing that data?
Yeah, no, I agree here, and I think what's compelling to me about this particular framework, the evolutionary framework, is that it very quickly asks you to step out of the just of looking just at the memes or just at the journals, and you're really looking at the ecosystem as a whole, which includes all kinds of things, like I said, institutional, cultural, editorial practices, and so on, and it could very well be that there's nothing wrong with the way humanities are done or whatever. It's true, and it's certain traditions are worth preserving. I'm not being cynical about it. Certain traditions are very worth preserving, and I think this model kind of gets to it fairly quickly. So thank you again all for coming.